I guess I should go ahead and get started.
And first, I just want to say that I'm really honored to be here with y'all at Holden. And you know, this is a really special place, and I understand why so many of y'all come back here year after year. And, this place has been really relaxing, eye-opening, and even sublime. As my time here is winding down, I feel more than ever like this overwhelming sense of sacred duty to carry out this work. Mm-hmm. And thanks everyone for being here at this session. It's probably the most critical of my three. So, and nothing's happening. Okay. So, how do you move an entire culture inland? It's no easy task, right? So, to make it even harder, these places have systemic racism baked in. But first, I'm going to give you all a little bit of an overview of the first two sessions for anybody who wasn't here for those. So, the high ground on this slide is along the rivers and distributaries of the Mississippi River. And when European settlers first came to the area, they settled on this high ground. And it was really productive for farming, and it was a little higher so they could kind of get out of the floods. But what they did, plantation owners in small towns kind of built their own little levees. And during the, they failed all the time. And during the Great Flood of 1927, 100,000 people ended up homeless from above St. Louis all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. And when that happened, the Congress authorized the MRT system, the Mississippi River and Tributary Levee System. And you know, for a long time, those levees protected people and property. And but what they did, they cut off the sediment that was flowing out into these low-lying areas for many decades. And so, over the years, those levees contributed to a sort of false sense of security, where before, natives were building mounds to live on, and early settlers were building their houses on piers, like stilts. Folks started building slab-on-grade homes in areas where they never should have been built. So now, these artificial barriers are being created to protect New Orleans and its suburbs. But after the levee failures in 2005 during Hurricane Katrina, Congress authorized the Corps of Engineers to fix the levees around New Orleans. Before Katrina, it was just a system in name. And this structure is called the East Closure Complex. And you're either inside of the wall or you're outside of the wall now. So, the state of Louisiana has endorsed the figure of 2.84 feet of sea level rise over the next 50 years. And that's huge for a red state, a state kind of built on the extraction economy, for them to admit this. And the 2017 master plan that's currently being drafted, that's the figure they're using to plan their coastal restoration projects. Now, that plan is updated every 5 years. In the 2012 plan, the least optimistic scenario of sea level rise is now the most optimistic scenario of sea level rise. So things are changing quite a bit. So the residents on the outside of that wall are facing an incredibly dire situation. But we'll talk a little bit more about what they're facing. So these folks are mostly left to fend for themselves. And the wetland buffer that used to protect those communities has either eroded or sunk. They're facing a situation where levees and utilities in the future may no longer be maintained. Even though those folks are lifelong taxpayers, and a lot of the wetland destruction was of no fault of their own. So we're going to have to rethink how to live with water. And there's quite a few opportunities for improvements to quality of life. And by using the multiple lines of defense strategy, people can still live in these productive places. And so, folks in coastal Louisiana know what's needed to create a sustainable coast. And you know, that's by reconnecting the Mississippi River to the wetlands. And by that I mean establishing a coast that's capable of protecting people, the culture, and the economy today and for generations to come. But how do different user groups with differing agendas and needs come together to make that plan the best for the common good? So this chart shows various species of commercially and recreationally sought after species. And this kind of corresponds to that multiple lines of defense strategy. You can see it's really linear, starting out here with the Barrier Islands, then having a land bridge and marsh, and then having hydrologic restoration, bringing new sediments into this area to keep up with the sinking coast. But species like brown shrimp and white shrimp and oysters are dependent on a certain salinity gradient. And when we reintroduce the river out into these areas, it's going to really change that system. So that's where we begin to hit problems. So how do we get here? You know, that's what I just kind of touched on. And it's mostly a man-made problem. So, but this second bullet here, as authority over the river, coast, and laws have become increasingly centralized, the power of local communities has diminished. And that's what it really boils down to. The people that are dealing with these issues don't really have a say in the matter, at least up until now. So, case in point, the Coastal Master Plan, it's created by scientists, but it didn't really authentically include residents, and it leaves a lot of folks in harm's way. For instance, my home is right here, and all of this work protects that stuff up there.
Should your home have been there in the first place?
It was safe for many years. People don't live down there. Let me go back. People don't live in areas like this because they're nostalgic or they like to look at the water. They live there because there's an economic need. There's lots of international shipping that goes to that port. Something on the order of 300 million tons per day. There's incredible seafood landings. This is the third biggest seafood port in the country by weight, including the big seafood ports in Alaska. There's something like 50% of the refining capacity in the country is in Louisiana. And there's an offshore port here. There's a floating buoy. 15% of the nation's crude oil goes to that point. And all those things take people to run. So then there was this plan called Changing Course. It was a design competition by three groups, and the state of Louisiana decided to declare all of them winners. They couldn't even really endorse one. They feel like they didn't have the gall to do that almost. So tons of money was funneled through this thing, and a plan was developed, and it was really kind of far out and high in the sky. Looking at this picture makes coastal residents furious. You know, my home would be here. Would I have to take a ferry, or would my community be abandoned? You know, outsiders were trying to determine our fate. So, all that said, the current conditions are not sustainable. And the river delta needs to be moved inland. So, Louisiana is one of the first places in the world to be dealing with these issues because we have sinking lands. So our relative sea level rise rate is much higher than areas all around the world. And we're the first to be dealing with these issues, but we certainly won't be the last. So all around the world, communities are going to have to move inland. And the next century is going to be, will experience the largest migration in human history. There are 180 million people in Bangladesh. Most of those 180 people live within 5 feet of sea level. They're going to have to move in for reasons not of their making. They hardly make any carbon in that country. So how do we make a plan that can be replicated all around the world that includes people that are going to have to live with the plan? And why do residents not participate in or feel left out of planning processes? First, we need to know why current planning processes do not work. And let's explore those. So these are some of the reasons. And they're a bit vague, and I want y'all to jump in if y'all have any kind of questions. I want this to be as interactive as possible. No deep democracy. People will come in and they feel like their ideas aren't listened to, or the planning process has mostly been decided, and there's kind of like a 3-minute comment period at the end. They're consulted on everything but the essentials. And I'm sure some of you experienced these things before. They feel like their insight is extracted versus having shared decision-making power. And the barriers to entry are high. They have meetings during the day. It's bureaucratic. There's jargon. It's kind of hard to understand. And this one here, folks are asked to be engaged too late in the planning process. Some of these structures and processes that are being developed right now, the state of Louisiana is asking for public comment when 60% of the design is complete. You know, it's not fair. And so there's this thing called expert bias. And again, it goes back to, you know, kind of outsiders trying to discern their, you know, someone else's fate. These experts don't really have an investment in getting it right. There's a consolidation of influence at kind of the highest levels. And also there's this mindset, this kind of history of colonization, which is, I'm sure you could see in your own communities. And so what does all this stuff lead to? It leads to wasted money. It leads to people not really wanting to participate, not buying into these issues, or these solutions. There's no deep democracy. I mean, it's the projects are no good for the area. They just don't fit. At the very bottom is one of the most important. They lead to injustice and human rights violations in some cases. So how can we change the old ways to bring people to the table who are speaking different languages, both literally and technically? Setting some rules of engagement and striving for deep collaboration are two good ways to start. But how does that happen? So let's get into the planning process and how it works. First, I want to talk a little bit about cognitive dissonance. So doing something when you know better, pretty much, right? So this is going to be a long and difficult process. And myself, I've been going over sea level rise data and land loss data for years. I've seen it in the places that I love, just entire islands and areas just go away. But yet I still choose to invest in my home that's in harm's way. And I, out of everybody down there, should really know better. So how do residents that don't know about these things react? And, but to start even getting to this point where people can see this data and start to accept it, there needs to be trust. So this group is going to come up with better solutions than if just the smartest person in the room were to come up with some sort of plan. And we often know that the government doesn't really have the smartest person in the room working on some sort of solution. So the theory with crowd co-design and what makes it different from these old ways where, you know, some governmental organization comes up with a plan and you get 2 minutes of comment at the end and you're mad at them and they're mad at you because the ideas are so wildly different, is that, you know, these groups are able to come up with what fits best for the greater good. And it's kind of a new term for this old practice. And it's like local direct democracy. People decide on their own fate, which for the most part, unfortunately, has kind of gone away here in America. And it's one of those things like, you know, flag waver, man, I love my freedom, but dude, what's happened to it? It's gone away. Yeah, we get to vote, but what happens after that? You know, these democracies kind of been hijacked. So,
wouldn't it be good to have an engineering hydrologist make some decisions than some longshoreman who's unloading 40-foot containers?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure so that would make sense, but you know, where's that hydrologist from? Is he from Sheboygan? And the guy that's unloading containers is probably, you know, he's living inside the levee system, he's more worried about his home. But the guy that's a commercial fisherman that understands the way this water runs locally around these islands in a particular way, in places that hydrologist would be just pouring over data that's collected by some sort of, you know, survey vessel that isn't even relevant anymore. You know, as soon as the survey is finished with, the data's no good down there because the land is changing at such an incredible rate.
But again, I'll just take another view, is if you have this crowd decision, I mean, that's one step away from mob rule, or it's one, I mean, when you're starting out, wasn't it sort of the individual local people that got this place built up and with the levees to be messed up in the first place? Is that true or not true? And then, so people living where you're living, maybe where you shouldn't, you know, 200 years ago, might not be the smartest thing to be building levees, to be living there. I just don't want to get away saying, you know, I don't want to disparage people like a trained hydrologist. I don't want to defer to a crowd and not listen to a hydrologist. That's kind of where you're, at least what you're saying, is you're leaning.
Yeah, that's exactly where I'm going.
Okay.
You know, and the thing is, all the science at this point, everything's been studied to death. You know, coastal Louisiana has been studied for, you know, the land loss there has been studied for many, many years. And the science is sitting on the shelf. You know, like, here it is, this is what needs to be done. But the implementation of that science needs to be decided by the people that are going to be dealing with those issues themselves. We can't shove it down their throat. They need to be the ones deciding how it's implemented. So, anyway, so the planning process is coactive, and everyone is leading. The residents doing the planning have ownership over the outcome because they will be affected the most. So anyway, when an entire community is involved in shaping a plan, expect these things to manifest. Trust, and I have it underlined because it's the most important thing of all. Awareness, they're gonna be fully aware of what exactly is happening and how to turn that around. There's gonna be consensus building, so people are gonna kinda come together around these issues. There's gonna be political momentum to get things actually done. And there's going to be connections between groups that otherwise probably wouldn't be collaborating. For instance, shipping and fishermen, scientists and residents, things like that. So the actual plan itself, and this is the kind of the big picture timeline of what's going on for this community-based co-design plan down where I live. And so it's set up in two phases. And right now we are at the end of the first phase. And so we have this document here, this engagement framework document. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the support team and then the core team. So So the support team meets bi-weekly to help handle logistics and make sure the core team and the parish-wide meetings are going to be as productive as possible. And so the support team is made up of experts, mostly from philanthropy, people that specialize in environmental studies and coastal restoration and sociology. These folks contribute knowledge in these different perspectives to make sure this process has the most firm footing possible and really includes everybody in a really democratic type of way. And so we're trying to guide the process to make sure it's fair and no one's left out. And also just, logistics and scheduling, those sorts of things. And we nominated the core team members. So the core team members are made up of a kind of a nexus of social, cultural, organizational, physical, economic, and education sectors. And that kind of hits everything. All the subsectors can kind of come out of those. So these folks, they set the rules of engagement. We brought them in, and this group was reflective of the census data. So it was the best we could do to make sure that, we couldn't get everybody in the room to set these goals, but, we felt like we could get 35 or so folks that were, a broad representation of the community to kind of do that. And so the planning that we had come up with as a support team, just kind of basic logistics, it was loose, and we floated it to them to make sure everything was jiving and everything was fair. And they came back with quite a few suggestions. So at this point in time, the first phase is complete. And so we're here. And the next slide, I'll talk a little bit more about the results of that process and how they were distilled. So these are some of the rules of engagement that the core team came up with. And they thought that these were the most important things going forward. And trust is a theme, and it keeps coming up over and over again, because there's this huge sense of distrust. I don't know if you remember maybe the second or third slide, this systematic racism kind of built into the system and how it consolidated at like the highest levels. A lot of folks have been feeling powerless and they wanted to get away from that. So being inclusive came up quite a bit. People wanted to be involved in their own faith, and they wanted to just organize from the bottom up, which, that's important, For a long time, these issues have been solved in some kind of air-conditioned building in Washington, D.C., 1,000 miles from the real problem, and the details really do matter. So, also respecting all voices. Some people have been shut out from these processes for decades, and they really need to be heard, because they have good ideas, and they need to be valued. And working together towards a common goal. While there's no less than 24 user groups there, we all need a sustainable place to live. And that's kind of the common goal, preserving that. Also, transparency. This planning process is going down, but it needs to be documented, it needs to be available in many forms. It needs to be, the meetings need to be broadcast far and wide. The notes need to be online for people to access afterwards. And one of the most important ones, and this is the one that I push the most, because without this, all this other stuff is just grant chasing. Pursuing action is the most important part of this plan, and we can't do anything less, because as a people, South Louisiana is going to go away if we do not pursue action. So, building trust, it's kind of nebulous, but, how do you do that? And, this kind of ties into transparency. But there's a few other things that are really important. Keeping your word, that kept coming up. That's really important. And showing respect. There's these people that have been marginalized, and, they're of many different races, and usually kind of at the lower end of the income spectrum. And then building trust. You know, you're not just going to build a trust by, you know, coming into a meeting and just sitting around for a few hours. You need to actually get out there and do something. Go out into the wetlands and see what's going down. Go out into different neighborhoods and see how they're affected. Those types of things. And I thought this one was pretty funny. When we asked the group, like, how can we achieve trust? So, some MK Ultra stuff right there. But this is important too, like conversation and actively listening. You know, I was watching this TED Talk the other day about, you know, having good conversations, and somebody was like, nod your head and look them in the eye. Well, how about just like actively listening, like really like hearing and processing what that person is saying and not thinking about like how you're going to respond, you know? And that's, you know, that's really, really important in this process. And then also, and this has to do with some of the science, you know, being direct, but don't be patronizing. These people aren't illiterate. They're not dumb. They see what's going on in their own way, in their own language, so to speak. And so, how do you know you're really achieving trust? Anyway, so how does one measure this unmeasurable quality? And it might be easier to measure trust by measuring distrust. And there's this thing called the squirm test. And, you know, if folks are kind of squirming around in their chairs, if they're uncomfortable, like cracking the back, you know, all that stuff, then they're probably not really trusting what you have to say. And then something else to look for, too, when folks are leaving the meeting, are they leaving mad? Are they kind of, you know, or are they shaking hands? Are they hugging one another? If you're seeing things like that, then you may be achieving trust. Also, when the participants start kind of using the lexicon of the meetings, you know, for instance, multiple lines of defense and a football field of land lost every half hour, those types of things. If people are engaged in this process from beginning to end, then you might be achieving trust. And to me, this one really stands out. An important sign of trust is when dissenting voices start turning their complaints into commitments. You know, anybody can complain about something, but when you take that energy of complaining and turning it into action to turn that problem around, then that is a huge sign that trust is there and people want to really make this stuff happen. And then this one might be the most important one, but when residents themselves take this process over, you know, when the philanthropy steps aside because, you know, the framework is there, and then the residents just take it over and build upon that. And so how do you achieve? This is how residents acknowledge, kind of how to, you know, include folks in the process. And using untapped knowledge, this TEK, traditional ecological knowledge, there's fishermen that just, they understand the food web so much better than a scientist that spends like a week, a year out in the bayous and bays. They don't have a fancy degree, but they get it. And they, like, these are people that can wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning because their collarbone is hurting, knowing that there's a change in pressure and the shrimp are gonna run. Like, there's just this really like deep knowledge of how these places work that's just been being avoided. You know, and it, there's this term that I'm thinking of right now. Some things just can't be fixed with money. That knowledge, you can throw a lot of money at something, but if it's not in the correct way, you're not going to really get something out of it. So this is, you know, how to be inclusive. But, you know, the first meeting we had, people just kind of came in and they sat at tables. And I'm sure people have noticed this, that people clicked off. You know, they went into their little clique. You know, the high roll and economic folks sat at this table, the education folks sat at that table, you know, the kids from the minority neighborhood sat at that table. And so what we did, they're just hearing each other. They're not hearing all the other voices. And so we had activities for the second core team meeting, and what we did, we assigned numbers at the table. So everybody sat in their little clipped off table like they normally like to do, and then we went around, you're number one, you're number two, you're number three, and so on around these tables, and that's how they did the activities together as a more mixed and homogenous group. So this third one, not about me without me, and that's like a direct quote from what was taken out of this process. And it kind of gets back to this whole thing that like democracy has been hijacked. You know, why should a bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. decide the fate of somebody in like coastal Louisiana? You know, ultimately that their plan is going to cost more and isn't really going to be the best fit for the community. And it almost equates to taxation without representation. And I'm sure y'all could remember some folks out in the Northeast throwing some tea into a harbor about that. You know? Moving out of your comfort zone, that's big. You know, that's why we had to kind of foist that on those folks to give them the numbers. You know, it's my time here at Holden, I've been trying to rotate tables at lunch and breakfast and dinner to, you know, talk with different folks and just kind of hear these other voices and live by that. Live by this, you know, to hear what these other people have to say. Excuse me. So, if all this is achieved, then you're going to have a lot of participation, and when the plan comes back, you're not going to have a lot of pushback because people are going to be involved. So, you know, we're at the end of phase one where the people came up with the rules of engagement, and this is what phase two is going to be looking like. So phase one was the plan to plan, but phase two is creating this plan, this resiliency plan for the county or the parish where I live. And the way we're going to do this is we're going to have these parish-wide meetings, and then we're going to break down into these smaller planning areas, and then we're going to go over some data together, neighbor to neighbor, around round tables, to where we could hash out these details at the lowest possible level. And like I said, that's to prevent this pushback later on in the process. So, anyway, and there's a few good things that are going to come out of this. You know, this plan, if it's developed by the community, people are going to have that sense of ownership, and they're going to demand that it be implemented. And so there's a few other just kind of logistics and housekeeping. They're going to be documented in the spirit of transparency. And then, you know, not everybody is, you know, everybody's good at their own thing. Everybody has a specialty. It's just kind of human nature. So the fishermen are going to kind of devise a little bit of a plan of their own, you know, organizational, and people are going to, you know, develop kind of their own thing, and then policy changes even will be developed, because that's kind of how we got to this point. You know, so anyway, these are some of the planning areas, but this has actually been updated, and so instead of using these hard and fast lines here, we're just using the dots. So if you live here, you know, you might have more in common with the people that live here, and you might want to go to this meeting. Or if you work down here in the Delta, but you live up in a protected area in the suburbs, then you might want to go to these meetings. So we just kind of left that up to the individuals to decide. But these local planning meetings are actually going to happen simultaneously, so nobody can just kind of hop from meeting to meeting and hijack the process. So I really like that. And so this is, you know, a bit, you know, mostly about kind of logistics and setting the groundwork, and I don't really want to get into what the residents are going to plan. And it could be anything, really. You know, it could be, everybody could decide, look, let's build our houses on stilts, or let's create a mound and live on top of that mound. You know, instead of having 120 miles of 12-foot high levees, it might make more sense to take all the material in those levees and build like a 30-foot hill and live on that, you know, and still build your house on stilts. Some communities might decide to move inland, whether that's as a group or alone. Other people might want to like think about some sort of houseboat that could be pushed out of harm's way. And that's kind of up to the community, and that hasn't happened yet because we just haven't gotten to that process. But there are ideas that are floating around that people are talking about that are very, very exciting. And this is one of them. A floating school. And this idea really, really excites me. There's students that just fall through the cracks of the education system for whatever reason. You know, it's kind of old school the way it's set up. You know, like, you know, you rotate through these classes and you stare. It's like this, you know, here I am lecturing to y'all or at you. And there's this new concept of education where a student picks what they want to study in arithmetic, in English, and other subjects follow what they want to learn, so the students become more engaged. But anyway, so in the area where I live, critical services like electricity and levees that protect the community, they might go away in the future for whatever reasons, but people are still always going to want to live in the Mississippi River Delta because it's such a productive place to be. And we have to think about new ways to live like that. So the floating school is one of those. So the way this floating school would go, there would be almost like a hub where administrative and core classroom and dorm space would be. And there would be separate barge classroom units that could be placed around the Delta. So for instance, the hub would be maybe down here in Venice where it's really yet to be determined. And then there would be these internship sites. So if you're studying, say, like Delta morphology or barrier islands, then you would take a boat out in the morning and go to that space, or even maybe stay there for a little while. And so the hope is to have the hub located adjacent to the school, almost like right over the levee from the traditional land-based school, to where there could be, you know, sharing of resources and those sorts of things. And so the idea is to use standard-sized barges like these pictured that are really common along the Mississippi River. And the school would be kind of this like intermodal or interchangeable unit that could be scaled up or down as necessary. And even the classrooms or other specialty attachments like power packs, cranes, those sorts of things could have standard bases for retrofitting between semesters as the course load demands.
So this is analogous to using like how shipping containers have become popular to use as modular structures, doing the analogous thing with barge transport?
Exactly. And so, in the event of a hurricane, this school could be fleeted together, put together, like the last slide, where all those barges are put together, and then pushed upriver to a safe location. And if the community is destroyed or damaged where it's unlivable for a little while, the students would have an intact school and a sense of normalcy at a community further upriver. So that would be much, much better for those students. And I can definitely tell you from personal experience after Hurricane Katrina, a lot of people did not come back because there was no school there. So anyway, if the town is damaged a bit.
Sorry, what age group are you thinking there?
High school students. So if the town is just damaged a little bit, the school could be brought back, and so that sense of normalcy could be back in the community while there's rebuilding or retrofitting kind of happening. And then this really interests me. This technology or idea can be easily exported to other areas. So there's areas all around the world that are kind of facing these issues, and we could be exporting this type of idea or even the physical space itself. And so I just want to leave y'all with this. And, this is all new to me. Like, I think of myself as a wetland guy. I'm not a sociologist, and I just kind of been thrust into this work, but I feel that it just needs to be done, you know? And so I want to leave y'all with this quote. And I challenge y'all to go out to your communities and just try to make the world a better place. Challenge the current way of thinking. And if y'all see things aren't happening as they should be, start organizing and demand that they do. It's a sacred duty. Thanks, y'all, for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Any questions?
This isn't a question, but I don't see any reason why those floating schools can't also be elementary schools and even preschools.
Yeah.
Because the dormitories could be used for different things besides just housing high school students. In the event of hurricanes, and elementary kids learn much better through doing, just like older kids do. And there's a program at LumCon, which is further along the coast, called From H2O, that is designed for elementary children to go out on a research vessel and do water testing and so forth. So I see that as just a wonderful possibility for pre-K through high school.
Great. Thanks.
Well, there's schools in Indonesia where there are floating schools.
I'll have to do some research and see how those are set up. What's that?
Saw it on television.
Do you remember the program?
See, no, that's true.
Do you remember the program?
Oh, dear.
No, I don't, but just check floating schools Indonesia and see. I'm aware of a really neat community-based plan in the, I think it's called the South Lafourche Parish. They're down, poking out into the Gulf, and they had a lot of damage during Katrina and also Rita. And their levees needed replacing, and the Army Corps of Engineers, who, as I understand, has sort of ultimate control over federal levee system, said, we'll give you X dollars and we'll build this quality of levee. And the parish got together just the way you're talking about. I don't know if the exact process was the same, but it was a parish decision, individuals working together to say, that's not enough for us. They turned down the federal dollars and built their own levee system to a higher standard. And that wouldn't have happened had the parish president just said, well, okay, we'll take the dollars and do what we want.
It's going to look way different in the future.
You have a lot in common with Venice.
Yeah.
Italy.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, this town down here is called Venice, Louisiana. And it's from the air. They look strikingly similar.
I have a question, and you might have, sorry, I came in late, so you might have addressed this earlier. With respect to climate change, where do you find yourself on the spectrum of this is something that I need to fight to prevent versus this is going to happen and I'm going to help people adapt to it?
I feel like we have to do both of those things, but at the moment, there's probably 3 to 7 feet baked in of sea level rise that is unavoidable at this point in time. And I'm not a climate scientist or a chemist or, you know, have that sort of background, but I'm just reading what's available. That being said, if we lose West Antarctica, everything in this photograph will be underwater. And
that would be 7 feet, or that'd be more than 7 feet? Like, how much rise would that West Antarctica be?
It could potentially be over 100.
Oh, okay.
It's very frightening. You know, but that's going to be like a several generation issue.
We won't have to worry about it.
That's kind of the problem. You got to.
That's how we got it, I suppose. I guess I'm curious, working with the community and just having your own sense of where things are going, what are the things that people you think are going to have to get used to that they're not ready for or haven't seen yet, like in terms of adapting to like a 5-foot level raise and the idea of refugees coming from there? What are things that people are going to have to get used to that they may not see? And then the second part is, what are things that might be a positive benefit come from this that might also be an unforeseen thing for people? Let me give an example in terms of the positive, in terms of like living in community in a different way where the scarcity of resources forces us to live in a way that might be more collaborative, communicative as a possible outcome. I'm not saying that's the thing, but that's like a way of looking at it.
Yeah, so touching on that, I would say that, okay, so from survey data, folks that live in suburbs, this is, you know, it's just a survey, it's what they've said themselves, do not have as high quality of life as folks living in a like a city neighborhood that's more walkable. And so those folks that are in the suburbs are actually using more resources. In a more urban environment where people are closer together, you're walking to work, you're biking to work, that sort of thing, you're actually happier and you're using less resources. So I feel like that's a huge positive that's going to come out of this. If people do that, there won't be so many rings on the bathtub. You know, right now we've got 7 feet baked in. Are we going to keep on blowing all of our resources and get that 100 feet? You know, I mean, it's up to us collectively as a people to do that, you know, and it's individual decisions, but then also I think we have to demand things from our lawmakers because the system is set up this way right now. But, I mean, if these folks want to remain in office, then they need to do what their constituents say, you know, you know, what you were mentioning earlier, you know, things are going to be different. We can mitigate, but then also we need to prevent it from happening further. You know, and I feel like there's a lot of technology there, and dude, like the human race, look at what we've accomplished so far. I don't see any good reason why we can't figure out how to turn salt water into gasoline. You know, if we really like put our money and minds to it and like, our existence depends on it, you know? Like, I mean, if we don't change the way we live, we're gonna go away. Dude, just 5 degrees of temperature is gonna completely alter the planet. There's gonna be rising seas. Think about these glaciers that y'all depend on here for your electricity and running water. Those are gonna go away, then what? Then it's gonna be drier, these trees are gonna dry out, there's gonna be forest fires. The Midwest is gonna have huge droughts. I don't want to dwell on that doom and gloom, but we need to be thinking about these things and striving to be better as humans, you know. Or right now it's South Louisiana, but tomorrow it's your neighborhood, you know. And that's why so many people are kind of behind this planning process. They want this to be like fair and inclusive, but at the same time they know it's really necessary. And we've got away from this democracy, you know, and we just need to get back to it. But I don't want to give up on democracy yet, you know. And I think we could have all these things, you know. We could have like a fair and democratic system, and then also strive to tackle these existential threats that the human race is facing.
I'm curious, though, but for you personally, so I work in sustainability and a lot of contact with people. One thing that surprises me is actually how terrible things are in how, if we don't need anything, things are actually going to be way worse than we can even imagine. And I meet people that recognize this, yet also have a certain level of recognizing how, you know, effed up things are, concurrent with a sense of hope and a sense of purpose. And I'm wondering, for you personally, how do you manage that polarity between a very real temptation towards despair with a hope that we can make things different? And I'm curious about your own personal way that you manage that, what I would imagine a polarity between the reality of the situation with the real work of creating hope and, you know, possibility in the face of that, for you personally.
I just try to strive to do the best job I can, mm-hmm. on this one particular issue, and I feel I know it well, and I can do my best to explain it to others, there's times that it feels hopeless, you know, but I feel like when I'm lying in bed dying, I don't want to be there and, man, like, looking at the ceiling thinking, man, I didn't do every single thing in my power to try and change this, you know? I just, and whether that's for 5 minutes or 6 months or 10 seconds, man, I don't want that to be my last thing. And that's just how I operate. You know, and locally, you know, I mean, it started off to protect areas like this that are going away. You know, like, all this used to be solid land out here in my lifetime. You know, and how can I change that around? And now it seems to be getting into these bigger issues that, for one, I might not have really asked for, and I've kind of been thrust into, you know, but I can't turn my back on them. You know, and I don't know if I answered your question or not. And I don't know, maybe I haven't thought about it that much. Maybe I don't want to think about it that much.
Yeah.
But it seems like there's a lot of very talented people all around the world that are demanding things change. And I think they need to keep striving for that. Anybody else have any questions?
Except that I remember in 1974 or so, when we were being held hostage with oil by the far Near Eastern countries, and everybody said we'd never have anything other than gas cars made by United States automakers. I don't think that's any longer the case.
Yeah, that definitely changed. You know, I feel like, you know, like the folks at Tesla are making some really great cars. The other day a car passed me on the interstate, and I'm like, man, that's an amazing looking car. And, you know, I got up close to it, and I didn't really notice it didn't have exhaust pipes. You know, and it was, it didn't look like some kind of, like, hippy-dippy car, you know, like a Honda Insight or something, man. I mean, it looked like a Benz. I mean, it was a sweet ride. And I'm like, I would totally drive one of those, you know. But I think we need to keep, you know, striving to get those affordable. You know, I'd buy one tomorrow if it was $20,000. You know, I can't spring for a $50,000 car, though.
Richie, I just want to thank you for being here this week. I really appreciate what you're doing and the leadership that you've been called to in this. And it's really inspiring. And I'm excited that Holden got you here, what you're up to. So thanks for coming. I know this is your first time here.
Yes.
And I hope you can come back. But thanks for being here.
Thank you all so much for having me, Kathy. I really appreciate you inviting me out here and sharing this really special place with me.
Well, I have to say, it's kind of karma. I got to know you, and you took me around for days around these places in your little boat and your bigger boat and the airplane flying over. And I said, Richie, how much do I owe you? And you said, nothing. Gas for the boat, and the knowledge that you had, and just, you know, being in a boat with you saying, this area we're going to run a boat, this was all land when I was born. That kind of experience was just just amazing. And so when Chuck and Pig asked me if I knew potential teaching staff here, I thought, boy, with our conflicted paradox of idyllic setting and human-made problems, mm-hmm. and living with water, you would be perfect. So I really thank you for taking this kitty corner trip across the country and being with us.
Thanks so much again. I really appreciate it.
So,